You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Liberia is declared Ebola-free, officially bringing the most recent outbreak to a close in West Africa. 11,000 deaths later, is West Africa any better prepared to confront another such calamity? And is the rest of the world any better prepared to respond? My guests Sebastian Borger and James Schneider will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including yet further evidence of corruption in sports administration as the World Anti-Doping Authority takes another whack at the IAAF. But why are countries as well as individuals willing to take such desperate measures to win at games? In Germany, further fallout from the large-scale assaults on women in Cologne on New Year's Eve. Does Angela Merkel have any answers to the anti-immigration voices now declaring that they told her so? And why would anybody pay for a copy of one of history's worst books written by one of history's worst people? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, among other publications, and James Schneider, senior correspondent of New African Magazine. Welcome both back to the programme. We are going to start tonight, perhaps unusually, with some unambiguously good news. West Africa's Ebola epidemic is officially over. After 42 days without recording a new case, Liberia has joined Guinea and Sierra Leone in being declared officially free of the disease by the World Health Organization. This brings to an end the worst ever outbreak of the disease, which killed at least 11,000 people since December 2013. At least 17,000 other victims remain in various stages of recovery. James, the first and foremost thing to say here is hooray. This is terrific, although the World Health Organization does it does caution that smaller outbreaks may still be possible. But did West Africa, as a, I guess if you can think of it as a single entity, learn anything from the outbreak?
So these three countries, that the Mano River countries that were affected, had their health systems absolutely crashed. And I think that's probably an even more important legacy than just the fact of the outbreak of Ebola. The number, you know, obviously horrendous, killed 11,000 people, shut down economies and all of that. But with fragile health systems that have to deal with already very, very heavy burdens, they weren't able to respond. So I think one of the lessons that has been hopefully learnt, and something that donors are trying to engage with, is how to build up the resistance in those health systems more substantially. So I think, you know, that's one of the positive lessons that can be learned.
On the subject of donors, etc., you mentioned that those three countries in particular, Liberia, Guinea, Sierra Leone, have suffered not just the loss of thousands of people and the illness of thousands more, but as you said, their economies have been devastated. Sierra Leone went from double-digit economic growth into recession. Thousands of children have missed up to a year, possibly more, of education as schools were closed. Is there a concern that the rest of the world in particular, which doesn't pay enough attention to West Africa at the best of times, we'll just read the headline saying Ebola now over and just think, oh, fantastic, we can worry about something else?
I mean, yes, quite possibly. And these are three countries that are coming out of quite precarious situations already. The 1990s was full of civil war in Liberia and Sierra Leone, which tore those countries apart. Guinea has had a dictator who died. There was a peculiar coup. There was and now it's coming to some, you know, it's had some kind of democratic order. They're already very poor countries, and as is often the case, the donors' eyes tend to not stay with the big ticket things overall. There has been a shift towards fragile states in the overall thinking of development spending and the development community. So they will get a bit more of a look in and a bit more attention. But they're not going to get, unfortunately, the kind of grand, you know, Marshall Plan style thing which would build fully, build infrastructure and build a fully resilient health systems.
Sebastian, to bring you in and to look at, I guess, the same story from the other end of it. During the worst of the crisis, there was a lot of criticism of the way it was reported by the Western media, in particular the non-African media. There was an awful lot of scaremongering. There was an awful lot of reversion to Heart of Darkness tropes when covering Africa, and there was an awful disproportion between the coverage afforded the relatively few white victims of the disease and the many thousands of black victims. Did you get the impression that the media has taken any of those lessons on board?
I thought, I have to say, I'm very far from being an Africa specialist. So out of the corner of my eye, the stuff that I read about it was actually overall fairly positive compared to what's going on. Now you can always say, of course, coming from a very low base, any reporting which is putting the African states in the center of the story rather than as a sort of a victim and of Western intervention is good, is better than before. But I thought the intervention programs worked pretty swiftly, and you have to say, of course, if a Scottish nurse gets infected twice, that sadly is more interesting to most people in Scotland and indeed in England than when 3,000 West Africans get infected. That's just a fact of life.
A lot of the reporting was, as you say, very bad. It brought out a lot of really, really, really terrible tropes. We had ridiculous things like the "Do they know it's Christmas" refrain with "There's fear in every tear" or something, "Death in every tear," I think they said. But the thing that is different and is that there is a sort of silver lining to it is there was a huge pushback against a lot of this bad reporting, and many journalists and editors are on Twitter, and many people in Liberia and Sierra Leone and Guinea have access to that. They can directly say, you can't put a dead child bleeding who's just bled to death on the front page of the New York Times. It's not an acceptable piece of journalistic ethics. And those debates were had, I think, much more robustly and much more publicly than they would have done in a previous crisis. So I think it is possible that the internal processes of journalistic ethics will mean that the next time something happens, the reporting will be less bad.
Well, let's hope so. And let's move on to our next story. We have long since passed the point, I think, at which it would feel more like a news story if someone released a report which found that some or other sports administration was a clean, well-run and transparent enterprise with only the game's best interests at heart. Today's release of the second part of the World Anti-Doping Agency's report into the IAAF suggests that the IAAF, in inverted commas, and I do love their choice of words, could not have been unaware of doping in athletics. Sebastian, should we surmise from their careful choice of words there that this is rather akin to a report into the Vatican suggesting that the Pope could not have been unaware of Catholicism occurring?
This is really devastating. This is devastating, and exactly the way that these Dick Pound, of course, is I think the head author, a very thorough Canadian, a lawyer, as you can see from those from the choice of those words, but it's a complete vindication of the reporting of the German television who first started it, ARD. This is an organization which needs to be shut down, taken out of Switzerland, a tax haven, put somewhere where it's actually being administered properly. And unfortunately, I have to say, although I have the greatest sympathy for him, and his own great victories in athletics, Lord Coe can't survive.
It is, of course, not necessarily that surprising, this report, given what we've already learnt. And it does have echoes of that other great Swiss-based sports administration,
indeed,
FIFA, which has had more than its share of difficulties over the last few years. But I did want to broaden it out into a question of why this happens, because the reason that this happens, of course, is that there is huge desperation to win by nations who want to succeed at sport. But James, first of all, why is it so important to win a medal at an Olympic Games or do well at a World Cup that it is worth, you know, going to these measures and running these risks?
Well, I mean, for individuals, the pressure to succeed is the pressure to succeed, and people take different courses of action. But for countries and for organisations, these are coming out of sports administrations, sometimes out of country sports ministries that govern their sports. And here you combine big money, big popularity, low oversight, and often, therefore, easy access to corruption. So you get these things, these institutions that then are meant to make up the bigger institutions, like the International Athletics, like FIFA. And they are based on, because they come out of slightly neo-patrimonial organisations themselves, and then that's what they become. Many of these organisations need to be completely broken up, and they need to be reconstituted, and they need to be reconstituted away from some of the national entities that make them up, which might seem somewhat sort of anti-democratic or against the countries themselves. But when so many domestic athletics organisations, football associations, and sports ministries are, some of the most opaque and the most corrupt elements in their countries, it's very difficult to see how those can be the building blocks for a decent international federation.
Sebastian, in your view, though, why does this still go on? I mean, the recent revelations we've heard about institutionalized doping in Russia have, of course, evoked memories of what went on, during the Soviet Union and its client states.
East Germany,
yeah, in particular. But that was seen as a fairly straightforward attempt to promote an ideology. Is that still what underpins it when nations do this, or when lengths of this sort are gone to win at international competition?
Well, let's start with one thing here. You talked about the pressure to succeed. I think there is also a very natural human instinct, an ambition, a joy to succeed. You want to, kids pitch each other and see who is the faster, and from there you have people who are just very good at it and love running or jumping or throwing whatever and are obviously much better than others at it. So there is this. The other thing is there's very, very, very big money involved. I mean, how much is, how, you know, for someone from a country like Jamaica or St. Kitts and Nevis, who's as good as Usain Bolt or people like that, this is a chance to become a multimillionaire, which is very difficult in societies which otherwise don't allow very much social mobility for lots of people. So, I think that's that you can't take away the individual's ambition to succeed from the whole discussion.
But James, what about the ambition of countries to succeed, though? And, I obviously, speaking as an Australian to an Englishman, I defer to your greater expertise in knowing
succeeding.
What it's like to watch your country vanquished on the field of play. Do you think it does make any particular difference, though, to how people see a country in the world, if it's successful on the sports field or not?
I think it does, which I think is why we're having this conversation. We do think that part of the reason why supposedly Labour increased their majority in 1966 is because England won the World Cup. Why did China want to host the massive Beijing Olympics and want its athletes to do well? There is a lot of sort of international chest thumping, and there is ways for countries to feel pride in what they do. Also to define identity. So, for example, There was a real push at the 2012 Olympics in London to have a South Sudanese representative running. And the idea there was that the reason why it was seen as such an important national project to do so was when people thought of South Sudan, they would maybe think of an athlete rather than thinking of warfare. So there are legitimate reasons why they would do that rather than just grandiose tub thumping.
War minus the shooting, to paraphrase Orwell. We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Sebastian Borger and James Schneider. Coming up next, Germany and immigration.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, Istanbul, London, Toronto and New York City. In Singapore, our bureau chief is Nolan Giles.
I think the most exciting thing about being based here in Singapore during this period of such rapid growth for Southeast Asia is the energy of the professional community here. So you have this Singaporean mindset of ambition and of hard work and of punching well above its weight, mixed with a community of people from outside the country that have come here to add more depth, to bring their knowledge, to bring their culture and their understanding.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
And you are welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Sebastian Borger of Berliner Zeitung and others, and James Schneider of New African. Let's look now at Germany, where once again the issue of immigration is dominating headlines, though on this occasion for roughly the most depressing imaginable reasons. The country is still trying to measure and to figure out how to punish what appear to have been large-scale orchestrated sexual assaults on women on New Year's Eve in Cologne and in other cities by groups of men, at the very least matching the description of asylum seekers from North Africa and the Middle East. Sebastian, first of all, we've seen over the last year attitudes to immigration in Germany shift dramatically from one extreme to the other in accordance with various events. How transforming, or I guess how definitively transforming, are these attacks likely to be?
I'm not so sure whether attitudes have shifted that dramatically as you claim. I think people have generally been a lot more welcoming than in a lot of Central European countries, but also than in Britain. I mean, Britain is shamefully staying away from this problem, as is Poland and Slovakia Hungary and places like that. There was then the shift in politics. That was where more or less open borders were declared. I think partly hoping that a shock through the system would make other EU partners sit up and get involved. That's clearly not happened. Quite the opposite. I mean, she's Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, is now being told by Slovakian Prime Minister that he knew all along, and that we now have to have a EU summit which talks about the events in Cologne. I mean, you can't get any more ridiculous, really. But clearly, I think two things ought to happen. One is the police needs to be needs to be on alert much more. I grew up in Munich. I was a crime reporter in Munich. It would not have happened in Munich. Cologne and the whole of North Rhine-Westphalia is clearly unable to police itself properly. And the other thing is that people are more cautious. There's no doubt about it. And borders will, the Germans will not be able to and will not want to take another million refugees this year.
James, as Sebastian correctly points out, Germany has stepped up to the migration crisis in a way that very few other countries have. As a response to that, some of those, I guess you could say, less generous countries have been saying since New Year's Eve to Germany, well, we told you so. This is exactly why we were cautious. This is exactly why we put fences back up. Is it possible they had a point?
No, I completely agree with Sebastian. I think it's a shameful argument. Germany is it's overstretched and it can't cope with as many people who have come in. I think that appears to be the case. There is a backlog in the system. There are problems on the borders. Too many people are dumped in hostels. There isn't enough going on. But that is because the burden has not been shared. And I think that I don't think that this problem goes away if Germany had accepted necessarily fewer people. But if resources had been shared and the burden had been shared, I think that the things that could have led to this taking place are limited. But also, I reject the idea that what is an absolutely horrendous and terrifying group crime. By group, I don't mean migrants. By group, I don't mean North Africans. By group, I don't mean asylum seekers. By group, I mean 500 or 1,000 men doing this horrendous group attack on women on New Year's Eve. That is not representative, and that is not caused. No, you can't say that. I don't think you can extrapolate out from those people to that whole those whole groups within society. So I think it's dangerous of the others to score that political point when they could be assisting, and they frankly should be assisting a lot more.
Can I just say, I mean, I actually do think they have a point. Yes, they do have a point. You cannot let in tens and hundreds of thousands of young unaccompanied men. That's what it is. You know, I think there are very few reliable statistics, but it's about 72% apparently, or let's say three quarters of all people who came in were young unaccompanied men. Now, young men of whatever nationality and of whatever society, you know, even if they haven't been totally traumatized by a vicious civil war, tend to be the risk takers, tend to be the ones who commit crimes. In any of our societies, it's always the same picture. So that is part of the problem. There's no doubt about it. And the fact, however shameful I think British policy towards refugees is, I think one thing that David Cameron and even the coalition before implemented, namely saying we'd like to take people from, if the few people that we take at all, from refugee camps, and we'd rather take families or unaccompanied children, is probably the better approach than taking people who have made a very perilous journey. And again, who takes the risk? Younger men much more than older men and families.
I think that's true. That is a superior policy, but I don't think that countries that haven't done that in a large-scale way. I mean, so take Syria. Britain is apparently going to take in 20,000 asylum seekers over 5 years, over the course of a whole parliament. Now, I don't think if that is the scale of your policy, you can turn around and you can say legitimately, "Ah, oh, we told you so. You shouldn't have been doing
well,
it this other way."
Well, to be fair, they don't do it.
No,
the Brits
don't do it.
It hasn't been Britain. It's been largely the Eastern European governments.
I think if they haven't engaged constructively in the process at all with Germany, I think it's quite difficult to turn around and say, "Ha ha, you know, we told you so," because essentially they've, by closing themselves off, they've pushed the problem towards Germany.
Just a final thought on this one from you, Sebastian. There's been some reporting in German newspapers quoting police sources saying they've been instructed not to report crimes by asylum seekers, or they've been instructed to play them down. Is a terrible situation like this made even worse by a suspicion that people are not being told the truth?
It would be if it were true. I don't believe for a minute it's true. Again, sorry. I mean, maybe the situation has changed completely. Maybe the regional government led by Social Democrats and Greens in North Rhine-Westphalia has told Cologne police not to report it. I doubt it. I simply don't think in our open societies you can't not report it. It would be madness, and I can't believe it happens. I certainly know from where I grew up, where I reported in Bavaria and in Hamburg and in Dresden in the east, that was always part of the story. And you know, you grapple as a police, as a fairly good and therefore sensitive police person, or indeed a journalist, you grapple with the problem how to report a crime by foreigners, because you know exactly what at least a considerable part of the population will make of it. But you don't deny it. I doubt it. I don't think so.
Well, finally tonight, we'll be staying in Germany, where the bestseller lists are bracing themselves to make way for an unwelcome new entry. Mein Kampf, the epically boring manifesto composed by Adolf Hitler in between servings of prison gruel in Munich in the mid-1920s.
Landsberg.
Indeed so, has gone on sale in Germany for the first time since 1945. The book was never exactly banned, but copyright was held by the state of Bavaria, who refused to publish it. That copyright has now elapsed, and a new annotated edition will debut in the non-fiction charts this weekend. Sebastian, my first and obvious question on two levels. Given that it's been freely available online, you can get the PDF for nothing at the click of a mouse, and or orderable from overseas, and also that it is fantastically tedious, why are people buying it?
Isn't it marvelous? I mean, it's a publishing phenomenon, isn't it? You know, we should maybe think of other books, other boring books, which we could annotate by a group of scientists for 5 years, and then. Resell, and maybe people will buy it.
Because this is what's been done. It's that the Munich Institute for Contemporary History have extensively annotated Hitler's original manuscript. James, they've said they've been at pains to unmask, as they put it, Hitler's false allegations, whitewashing and outright lies. Does this require unmasking at this point? I mean, his case has been pretty thoroughly discredited by now, hasn't it?
Yes, it has, and it doesn't take much for anyone with any critical faculties to do it for themselves. But I think the point is this, is when the copyright expired, you have to look around and think somebody is probably going to publish it, and it is going to enter into the book charts in some way. So probably the best way in which you can do it is you bring out a careful, scholarly, critical tome. You're sort of fairly apologetic about the fact that you're bringing it out, but you have to bring it out to say how terrible Hitler is, and then really that's the one that gets brought out, rather than what could happen, because, you know, as you correctly say, it wasn't actually ever a banned book. It could be brought out by some unsavory element who, you know, might put on a favourable introduction, or, you know, I don't know how you would, but, you know, they might try to do something, and this is a sort of careful way of heading that off. Must have been quite a boring project to work on.
Excruciating.
A spin doctor of really rather great qualities for the introduction.
It would need to be. But seriously though, Sebastian, is there, however carefully or judiciously annotated, is there actually anything that we can still learn from Mein Kampf at this point?
Interestingly, I spoke to the guy who reviewed this book for my paper, Berliner Zeitung. He's a very well-known historian himself. He's very critical of this edition because he says they've totally overdone it. They're telling exactly what you thought might happen. They're telling all sorts of things which really everybody who has ever looked at any German history of the last 100 years knows anyway. And have in other parts of the book, apparently, I can't judge for myself, not explained the context of what Hitler was actually writing about, his own personal experiences in the Austria of the 1900s. It's an interesting dilemma, and it's clearly not solved. There are fascinating parallels with some of the way that politicians nowadays talk about their backstory. That's very much what he did, apart from all the conspiracy theories about the Jewish people and the Western powers, etc. He talks about his own development, and of course it was, when you look at it from that point only, a tremendous backstory, which you couldn't make it up nowadays.
Even if he wasn't the best teller of it. We will have to leave it there. Sebastian Borger and James Schneider, thank you both very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Federica Romaniello. Our studio manager was Chris Chalvers. For the next half hour, Carlotto Rebello is in with Monocle's International Playlist. At 1900 hours, Ben Ryland hosts The Urbanist. At 2200, Peter Cardwell hosts The Daily. This show returns, also hosted by me, at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.